And welcome to another episode of The Theatre Review, a show that's all about celebrating people who are rocking their unique power. I'm your host, Heidi Alexandra, and thank you for joining me again today. Today I have a very special guest, and her name is Michelle Locke. Michelle, are you on the phone?
I'm right here and waiting.
Excellent. Fantastic. And I'm very drawn when I remember I looked at your website and that it said Leading Humans in particular, because my very first business was called Leading Value, Leading Humans. So I knew straight away that we would have lots in common to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an evolution for me too, and become, you know, a bit of a passion. So it's very exciting.
Cool. So let me share a little bit about Michelle and why I also wanted to bring her beautiful, unique powers to the airwaves today. Michelle is a speaker. She's also an author and she's a mentor. And she really focuses on bringing substance to leadership and helping leaders, I guess, develop themselves in practical ways so that they can be more influential, increase their impact, and become one of those leaders that we really want to follow. I think in the experience I've had of Michelle, she's not only inspirational and motivational, I would say, but she's also incredibly practical, very strategic, and also really down to earth. So I can imagine the people who are mentored by you find themselves in a very fortunate position, Michelle. Tell us a bit about what brought you to what you're doing right now. What's your story?
Yeah, look, thank you. And thank you for that lovely introduction. It's been a really interesting journey. It was never an intended destination. I started out sort of as a teacher. I found myself in a human resources role for a number of years and in one of the big corporates, one of the big professional services firms, actually, which was a very interesting and challenging but, you know, fascinating journey, I suppose, and experience. And then about 10 years ago, I decided that it was a good idea maybe to do a coaching course, a coaching skills course. And I happened to choose a company that was neuroscience based. And my trainer was David Rock, who's now Dr. David Rock. And David is now in the US and has set up the Neuro Leadership Institute. So I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time. I ended up working for David for some time to really be on the forefront of this joining of what we were learning in neuroscience with the concept of leadership. And what I loved about that, and what I still love about that, as an underpinning, it's not everything I do by any means, but it underpins in that it brings some hard science to what we used to refer to as soft skills. And it helps me to communicate the why, I guess, to leaders and organizations as to why we have to put effort into developing leaders to be, in my view, you know, leading humans. So for me, to lead humans, you need to be a leading human. You need to really understand the human condition and how to work with it. At the end of the day, that's all we have is the humans in our care. So, you know, and I've just evolved over time and you know, have created some experiences for organisations that are hitting the mark, and that's really exciting for me.
Wow. So I love so much of what you're saying, and I couldn't agree more from the experience I've had working in corporates and now with corporates, is that soft skills have really gone hard. They've become the thing that we need to be learning and developing even more. And I keep banging on about the fact that the more high tech the world gets, the more high touch we need to be as leaders. And you know, I kind of label myself sometimes as a workplace humanist, because really most of the stuff that I see is necessary is just trying to make some of the things more human again and bringing it back to how do we lead with our humanness? How do we consider people as human beings and not human resources? So the businesses you work with and using that sort of neuroscience backing, what are some of the transformations or the things that you've helped them achieve?
Yeah, great question. So this idea of bringing substance back to our leadership and also our lives is where I've been focusing. And for me, the, you know, a leader of substance is someone that has, you know, we focus on three things. The first thing is to give leaders a really deep understanding of human motivation. Mm-hmm. And that's where the science comes in, to really understand what makes us tick, what shuts us down, what opens us up. And, you know, inherent in that is performance and productivity come from human beings that are, you know, fully functional, mm-hmm. And continuously, you know, have that desire to become better versions of themselves. Mm. You know, organizations need to become better versions of themselves, because we can almost no longer compete on the technical level. Our sophistication from a technical perspective is so great now across the board that it is the difference around, do I have that engaged and motivated culture to propel us forward? Because, you know, standing still is the new going backwards, you know. that is that. So that's one aspect. The second is self-leadership. And, you know, I really have a bit of a bent or a rant around this idea that we pay people in our organizations to turn up as fully functional human beings. And I'm a little frustrated by where we've got to, where people in organizations expect an organization to look after them. Mm-hmm. And I think that leaders firstly have to engage, you know, in their own exceptional self-leadership. And that's about also, you know, understanding their bias and being capable of being emotionally in control, mm-hmm. and making, you know, unbiased, you know, judgments and decisions, but also in terms of being healthy and well. And I think we should expect that of our human beings. We should support them, but we should expect that of our employees, I should say, as well. Mm. What happens, though, with all of that? So the first area is the human motivation. The second is the self-leadership. For me, the real key here and the difference is the quality of the way we have conversations.
Right.
So I would argue that, you know, your culture is your the culmination of your conversations. And if you just simply start going to an organization and start listening to the focus of the conversations and how the conversations are being held, you will get a sense very quickly of the culture. And I think it's there is the leverage point. If we can change the way people understand each other as humans, if we can really support people to be better versions of themselves and display exceptional self-leadership, and we can give them the skill then of the powerful conversation, you know, and the connecting conversation, which for me is around, you know, brain-based coaching skills, then we can really start to make a difference.
Ooh, all the hairs on the back of my neck are standing up. and I think what immediately kind of came to mind was change the conversation, change the culture. And I know for us at UQ Power, we do a lot of company culture architects, and my team and I will say in the first 3 minutes of walking into an organization, we've already got a feel for the culture. And then we have to ask the right questions and do the audit things to put the science to prove what our gut has told us. And so I love your thought around that culmination of conversations, because it is that. It is the mood of a place. It's what's being said and not being said, or the unspoken and spoken ground rules. It's the glances and body language as well as the conversations, isn't it? It's really all of that that creates a culture.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's funny because that is one of my mantras, you know, change the conversation, change the culture. And it's true. What a culture is not is not the words up on the wall that are our espoused values.
Mm, mm.
And I think one of the challenges too is that there are the things we want to value, or the things that the leadership says we should value, and then there is the reality of what we do value.
Yeah.
And until we can get people to stop and take the filter away and listen in a way that they really hear the values, and then understand, is there a shift to be made? Because people will subconsciously feel a dissonance, like a cognitive dissonance, when the values up on the wall are not what they experience.
Mm. Yeah.
And they won't necessarily be able to articulate that, although that's what I aim to go in and teach people to do, is to actually show them how to stop and go, why am I feeling this way? Mm. Put some language and framing around it, because when we can understand something, we can start to manage it and control it. But often what we're experiencing as humans in an organization is something we don't have a language for or a framework for. And that's what I aim to do, is to give people that so that they can then start to go, oh, I can see what's going on. So, you know, I think, you know, I talk about the work that I do as being, you know, giving leaders in an organization an unfair advantage in people management.
Right.
And it's about teaching leaders in an organization and wider than leaders if we can manage it, to diagnose the human behavior that they observe and experience, so that they can prescribe more appropriate and useful outcomes or, you know, next steps. And I think it's a nice metaphor for, yeah, let's go in and with every interaction we have that doesn't feel good or useful, let's try and do some really objective diagnosis.
Yeah.
And we can't do that unless we have a framework and language.
It's really interesting, because I know often I'll see workplaces and they say, oh, we trust, there's full accountability, there's no blame culture. And then I'm like, so why, when I look at the emails that you're sending to each other, are you CCing in 20 people or kicking that back up the line? You know?
or BCCing.
yeah. So, and often that's an unspoken ground rule, or it's a bit invisible because we're not quite conscious of what's happening. But when you call people out, they go, oh, yeah, I am kind of covering my bum, because if I don't, this could happen. So it's fascinating to hear what you're doing in that work, and I'm sure the organisations who are working with you are grateful for your existence and your thought leadership and the work that you've put into developing what you do.
Thank you.
So I'm going to flip the tables on you and have a conversation with you now. And that is to invite you to choose five numbers for me between 1 and 52. And I've got our deck of cards, the cards for uniqueness against the ordinary. And I can tell you're anything but ordinary, Michelle. So what would be your selection of five numbers?
Yeah, okay. So let's go with, so it's 1 to 52, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go with 52, my age, 22, 17,
yeah,
19, and one more, is it? Five.
Yeah. One more, and number five. Beautiful. Number so five. 52, 22, 17, 19, and five. Amazing.
Perfect.
All right, straight to the back of the deck for the first one. Question 52, Michelle, is, are you a morning, afternoon, or evening person?
Oh, wow. I used to be a morning person and I want to be a morning person again, but right now I'm struggling to be an anything person. I think I'm at that age where I'm just tired. No, I think more productive in the morning, definitely. And I think the secret there is in routine. And when we get into routine and we don't have to be making too many choices, we have the energy to, you know, exert what we want and be much more focused in the morning. So morning.
Yeah, right. And creating that space for whatever you need to do. It's because your brain's not.
Yeah.
I remember when Barack Obama was the president and they always talked about the fact that he had the same grey suits and blue ties or this election. And so that was so that he didn't have to waste his energy set on deciding what he was going to wear. It was just the same thing.
Yeah. Which is really difficult for us as women, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. Question 22. Oh, this is an interesting one for us women as well. All right, Michelle. Question 22 is, what are the bright, shiny objects that attract you?
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to be very girly and start with shoes. And it has become a bit of a thing when I do keynotes of a bit of the, you know, oh, look at her shoes. So I do like to go in search of cool shoes.
Yep.
But let me think a little more deeply about that. Bright, shiny objects. I am an innovator.
Mm-hmm.
And I do love to follow an idea.
Ooh, tell me more about that.
I'm very interested in reflecting and making connections, and this is what I teach people to do in organizations as well, is to set up the perfect brain environment to have insight.
Mm.
And so for me, helping people chase the bright, shiny idea to a point of insight,
mm-hmm.
is really exciting. And that's me as well. It's like, let's go down that road and see where we go and see if it's of real value. So I think that's really great.
Ooh. Have you done your Gallup strengths test?
Oh, a long time ago. But I do know, I do a process of brain mapping.
Yes.
And in that we have eight dimensions, and we look at how many of the, it's a neuroscience-based brain mapping tool, and which I love. And there are eight dimensions, and the idea is that we can be any combination, but in some cases we are extreme strength, and in some cases we avoid these particular dimensions. It doesn't matter whether we have, you know, it doesn't affect our capability, but it's our energy around them.
Yes.
And unfortunately, I am off the scale in six of them, which means I can have a very confused mind. And what it means actually is one of them that I'm very, very high on is innovation. Mm. And I'm also very high on what's called focusing, which is being very single-minded. And so when I see something that's of interest to me and it's new and interesting and exciting, then that's my shiny thing.
Right.
And not only will I follow it, I'll follow it with a doggedness that can be very frustrating for the people around me.
Right. So you go down that rabbit hole and your tail can't be seen for miles.
Pretty much. But there are obviously great advantages to that as well. And part of that is, you know, when I can get into organisations and I can really go, you know, well, my reputation used to be, my nickname used to be the terrier at my workplace, because it's like if you really want something done and sorted and figured out, give it to Michelle because she'll pursue it till its end. And I think that's great. I love that. It's like all the things that we have about us, there's, you know, there's shadow sides mm-hmm. and there's bright sides, but I think those, being aware of those things can mean you can use your strengths to, you know, to advantage. So
yeah.
So following ideas and shoes.
Absolutely. And you're a woman of my own heart, because shoes is the one thing that I cannot resist as well. And I am a bit of a researcher. So when I really get into something as well, I'll read every book about it and go deeper in it until that's all I can talk about. So I'm totally with you. And it sounds like we're overdue for a coffee catch up to go deep into something.
I think so. I'll take you up on that.
And we can compare shoes. So. All right. Question number 17. Okay, this one's interesting. Michelle, what's your favorite board game to play?
Ooh, favorite board game. I'm really a cards player rather than a board game, but do you know I like trouble?
Oh, yes.
And that's going to sound a bit sort of pathetic, but when you have children, you kind of revisit your youth a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I like trouble because I don't have to think much.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, the reason I like cards is because I have to think a lot. Mm-hmm. But you can be quite strategic with cards, whereas board games are fairly straightforward. And I just love that sort of, you know, press that button and then try and land on someone and wipe them out. And my kids hate it because I never let them win.
You're not a kind mum. You're a competitive one.
I'm that's their life lesson, Heidi. It doesn't always go your way.
Here's trouble. You're not going to win.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a game we can start and finish and move on quickly and get on with our day. So,
Love it. I haven't seen that game, I think, since the 80s, so it might be time for a revisit.
Oh, no. It's hilarious. It takes you back to your youth.
A bit like Uno, that used to be that era as well, the good old camping card game. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course there's Monopoly, but now there's so many different versions of Monopoly, but Monopoly takes too long.
Yes, agree. Takes too long just to set up. I'm already done by the time the board's out.
I think that says something about our capacity for concentration.
Yeah, that's the bright shining object thing. All right, question 19 is the next one, and that is, what are you excited or curious about?
I'm really curious about how we are going to get ourselves out of the hole that I think we're in as a society. So this is my substance stuff around, you know, what I'm thinking here is that we've lost a sense of substance. We've lost the groundedness in our lives, in our organisations, and I think it's really starting to take a toll. I almost can't watch the news anymore. And, of course, now we're facing things like data fiction and fake news, and we don't even know what's real anymore. I didn't even know anymore for sure that when I dial into my online bank account that someone has hacked in and directed me somewhere else, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm very curious, and it's, again, why I'm passionately pursuing bringing this substance back and saying, don't even pick up the phone. Get up and walk around and talk to someone. You know, one of the things that I say is that, you know, conversation is the most sophisticated technology we have for getting things done. And we don't use it. And not only that, we don't train in it. We don't invest in knowing how to do it really well. So, and now that we have science to back up and give us another layer of knowledge on those conversations, I think it's in a really exciting time. So I'm curious to see where we go, and I think we'll either realize where we're at and start to think differently about, you know, how we exist in organizations and how we treat each other, or we'll continue on the road we're at and we'll see our demise.
I'm with you here, and I do see a bit of a split happening in the world, you know, and we do have a bit of a choice. We could go the one or two ways. And my next book that I'm writing at the moment is called Up Yourself. And it's about being up yourself. It's about upping your unique powers, and it's about investing the time and energy in really knowing yourself, and then how can I connect and relate and be with other people. It's all about what's the depth and substance that's not the selfie on Facebook, and it's not about the keeping up appearances because someone else told me that I need to do that, or because, you know, competition says that. It is about that coming home to self and starting conversations with self first. And that's why I have questions for this podcast, because I really believe questions are the answer. They're what help us go deeper and switch on our, you know, neurological pathways, rather than waiting for a guru, a leader, a teacher, or someone else to tell us. So I'm 100% with you on that, and I look forward to co-creating the new way with you.
Well, and I was thinking the exact thing. I think there's a number of us on this journey, and each of us are packaging it in our own way. And I think that's important, because we need to be able to take this message forward in many different ways. And I think we need to hear the message and uncover the issues in lots of different ways so that we get it. We have a depth of understanding around it. And one of the philosophies that I have kind of, you know, created around this is threefold, and that is that as an organization, as individuals, and as a society, we need to do three things, and that is to get naked, to get nurtured, and to get nudged. And it's about, the naked is about the truth.
Yeah.
Because we really don't, there is no truth. There's your truth, there's my truth, there's possibly a truth.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult for us as human beings, and what gets in the way in terms of what goes on in our brain to A, sometimes even want the truth. So, you know, for me, I teach leaders how to tell the truth. And that's about understanding their own cognitive bias and getting away from that. They need to be able to hear the truth, right, to truly listen. But they also need to know how to find the truth. And, again, I think that's the conversation and the questioning techniques.
Yeah.
The nurtured is around our need for psychological safety. We're pretty okay with focusing on physical safety because we can see that, but we can't always see a psychological dislodgement. Mm-hmm. And we have to get better at that. Our capacity as leaders to notice when people are destabilized and to nurture them back into that safe mental space, because we're not going to get the best from them.
Yes.
And in fact, it could be very toxic if we don't do that. And you won't get the truth if you don't have psychological safety. So
yeah,
get naked, get nurtured. And then the get nudged, you know, we tend to be a bit all or nothing.
Mm.
And, you know, one of the other things I will often say is that change happens one conversation at a time,
mm.
not in one conversation.
Oh,
and
I like
it is
that.
It is a gentle nudging, and it is a step by step. And I want leaders to be present to what have we got from this conversation, and what is the small step that we've taken in bringing this person on the right journey, or supporting them to grow and develop, or to evolving both our thinking. A definition for me of a powerful conversation is one where both parties or all parties leave the conversation with different thinking to when they came.
Right.
We all have to be open to going into a conversation and come out thinking differently. And to me, that's the power. But we often go in, I want them to see my side.
Hmm.
And it doesn't really, it gets us a little way, but it certainly doesn't get us, it's not a conversation of substance in my mind if it's one-sided like that.
I love your idea of the change happening one conversation at a time, not in one conversation. And I think an organization we've been working with recently were doing inductions for new employees and wanting to just ram everything to them in this big one day. And we were kind of like, you're trying to get them to drink from a fire hydrant, and you kind of need to have one conversation at a time, and also to allow the relationship to kind of grow and be nurtured, and not just expect that, bam, there you go, we give it all to you and, you know, you're good to go and you're going to be a loyal Absolutely. Servant from day one.
Yeah. Well, you know, we as we walk through the world, we get hit with about 11 million bits of information, you know, in any second.
Mm.
And our brain's capacity is around about, you know, to absorb is around about 100,000 out of 11 million.
Mm.
And it will only absorb the things that are relevant for it right now.
Yeah.
So if you think about the induction, what do they need to know today?
Mm.
To that they can go, that's interesting and useful, and I can make a connection and I can encode that, because anything more than that is just, A, the brain can't handle the volume anyway, and if it's not a relevant piece for me today,
yes,
then I'm just not going to, I'm not going to pay attention to it despite my efforts, you know. And when we first started this research, they used to say that we could hold 11 complex ideas at any one time in our logic brain, in our prefrontal cortex. Then they said 7, then they said 4, now they're saying 1.
Oh, wow.
So literally when we try to manage more than one complex piece of information, we lose performance. So we lose the capacity to, you know, compare and contrast or make meaning or manipulate or whatever it is. Hence why we need coaches and mentors, and hence why my office is surrounded with whiteboards. Because I think on my whiteboard, because I just can't keep everything in my head.
Yep.
And it's also why models and visuals work, because we have far more capacity in our brain to work with a simplified model, a representative model, than we do with words.
Yes.
And just teaching organizations these simple things can change the way they start to interact, to make sure that those interactions are more useful.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when I'm often talking to people how to communicate, I'm like, it's what the sender receives and hears and observes that's most important, not your message that you're selling or sending. And that's yet right. I'll see people do a PowerPoint with 63 million words on a slide, and I'm like, what do you think they're going to get from that? You know, the confused mind will say no. I love that you shared it's only the one complex thing at a time, because I thought it was still around the 5 to 7 bits. So that's an insight for me.
It doesn't mean we can't. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean that we can't handle 7 bits.
Mm.
We just don't do it very well.
Yeah.
And so this is the concept of just chunking down and saying, all right, so there are 7 parts of this. Let's identify them, and now let's just look at one.
Yes. Yeah.
And let's, you know, bring, and also there's the concept of, you know, holding new ideas in the prefrontal cortex and then moving it to the part of the brain, you know, which is our automated behaviors. And so, again, if we go back to the induction analogy, the idea is of the 10 things that we want them to do as part of our work and culture, we want to, you know, highlight one or two, move them into auto mode, because then the brain doesn't require that energy to maintain them, and it can bring in two new ones.
Yeah.
So it is that process, and you know, I love your I love your analogy of the fire hydrant. You know, drinking from the fire hydrant, it's just too much.
Yeah. And we're already assaulted with information, you know, via email, our phones, text messages, instant message, you know, the media. So we're already in constant overload. And then when someone's shouting stuff at us, it's just like, oh, I'm going to check out because it's just too much.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, we talk a lot in organizations about people being focused. And the thing is that the brain doesn't focus by focusing. It focuses by eliminating distraction. But distraction is seen by the brain as novelty and therefore desirable.
Yeah.
So we're in a real conundrum. And it takes, as I've said before, exceptional self-leadership and exceptional understanding of what's going on around you to manage that, because we're just not designed, you know, from an evolution perspective of our brain, we're not designed to operate in this world.
Mm.
And hence, you know, your passion and my passion for unlocking some of the new secrets around what it is to be human and how to manage that.
Fabulous. And it just reminds me even more why I do my best writing when I'm out in the backyard under a tree without any technology, because it's eliminating distractions. All right. Lucky last question. You've done exceptionally well. Thank you for sharing all of your amazing insights. And this is a really interesting one, I think, for our closeout question. You chose question number 5 for your final one, and that is, when have you acted or felt like an imposter?
Oh, goodness. Oh, every day of my life.
Wow. Okay.
Let me try and zoom in a bit better, though. Look, I think we get into that state when social norms, which don't necessarily make any sense, interfere with who we really are and what we're capable of. And to give an example, so I don't have a master's degree. I don't have a PhD. It's something I would like to pursue one day, because the world says, gives me a tick if I do.
Mm.
But does that make me any better at what I do? Does it give me any, you know, further depth of knowledge? I actually don't believe so. But there are times when I first started on this journey, when I stood up and went, I can do this and I know this, but I wasn't quite sure. And I felt like an imposter. I felt like I was going into a sort of pseudo-academic world that I wasn't entitled to be in. But, of course, all those experiences are what make us, and I think it's those experiences that enable us to help others. So it's pretty hard to help somebody with some, you know, it's hard for me to understand what it's hard for me to help someone who feels like an imposter if I haven't felt that way myself.
Yes.
And I think you can see it as a positive and as a negative, and I think every person goes through it, and I think none of us show it on the outside. So when I say things like that, people look at me and go, would never have guessed that.
Yes, right.
But it is all about our internal self-talk, and, of course, this is about being present to the, you know, to what's going on inside of us. And it's about self-love and self-belief, and I guess that's our life journey, isn't it, to be that fully self-expressed individual who is comfortable in their skin.
For me, that kind of takes me back to your, which I think is your future book coming, Get Naked, Get Nurtured, Get Nudged, you know, is that we have to be prepared to be vulnerable, to be naked and to find our own truth, in amongst all of that, so that we can step away from feeling phony. Because until we really know what is unique about me and what is it that makes me tick, then we're always taking those cues from outside of ourselves.
Absolutely. And I think it's about owning it. I think it's about, you know, I'm 52 now, and I think every year that goes by, I own more of who I am and apologize less.
Yep.
And I think that's a good thing, but I think it's a journey, and it's a journey of discovery. And then it is the capacity then to develop a level of wisdom that you can share back. And it's the evolution of our lives, isn't it? And I think when we can observe ourselves going through that, that's when it becomes powerful, and that's when we become wise. And I do think a lot of people wander through life not observing, just experiencing.
Mm.
And I wonder if the people who are like that never feel imposter syndrome.
Right.
Because they're not even present to it, you know.
Yeah. They don't go deep enough or land long enough to even allow that to come in.
Yeah. And the reality is that is the beauty of what education does for us at any level. I know that, you know, when I went to teachers' college, which I guess was the form of university that I experienced, it just opened my world to different things and made me think differently and gave me, and then the world I've been in with this neuroscience stuff and leadership has given me the privilege and opportunity to be capable of observing myself.
Mm.
And I think that's what keeps us real. And it brings me back to this idea of, if you're going to lead humans, you need to be a leading human. And that doesn't mean you have to be perfect.
Yeah.
But I think it's to be an objective and effective observer of yourself and, you know, what you're creating, how you're evolving and how you're impacting others. And I think any of us who get to do that and are lucky enough in this world to be educated and present enough to do that, I think that's the privilege. And I feel very privileged to be able to do that.
Wow, what a gift those words are as a concluding question, and the thought of objective and effective observer of self. And I know in the past week I've started working with a new yoga instructor, and she teaches yoga in the traditional Indian way, and the depth of her observer of herself and what she shares and teaches is quite profound. And your words have just had the same kind of effect on me. So I hope that that has been of service to the people listening, and I'm sure you'll all agree that the things that you've shared today, Michelle, have opened our minds and fired some of our neurons and made us think about, you know, where are we falling trapped to the self-talk and maybe not being aware of it? You know, how are we going with getting ourselves out of the hole that we're in, maybe in getting into some control and reality of what's real, and how can we have more powerful conversations? So thank you so much for being part of the Theatre of You today.
You're most welcome. I really enjoyed that.
You were great. So I'd love you to share as well, if there are people going, ooh, 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 how do I find this lady? Where can they find you? Where do you hang out, Michelle?
Sure. Look, I guess, you know, my website's the easiest place to start, which is just michellelock.com. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I just love having conversations, and, I love what I do, and I love the people I get to work with. I think that's the main thing, is that you attract the people that are meant to work with you.
Yeah.
And it's such a joy to do so.
Brilliant. So check out Michelle, and it's michellelock.com. She also has some amazing books, such as Your Brain is Your Business and 52 Awesome Weeks of Awesome Leadership. So we can't wait to hear when the Naked Nurtured and Nudged comes out, Michelle. Thank you once again for sharing your insights and wisdom with us today.
You're welcome.
And for anyone who's listening, if you're going, oh, how do I find out more? We'll be sure to also put a link for Michelle's information in the show notes below. And I know she's also on LinkedIn, so check her out and connect there. It's up to all of us to make these connections and start to, I guess, change the world and choose that new world ourselves. If it's going to be, it's up to me. And as I always say, if you want to change the world, all you have to do is start with you. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Bye for now.